Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back. So we'll be basically trying to give a summary of what I think is the current status of the theory of structure formation, or the way I, as I understand it, as the theory that can tell us how to connect the early universe from the period of the CMB to the kind of galactic population that we observe today. And what I'm going to try to describe is that I think there is a need to generalize this theory to include new dark matter interactions. So in this talk, I will describe how those interactions can be introduced into this theory to generalize it. And it's always not a particle physicist, so my approach is more phenomenological. So I try to put these new interactions in ways that are effective. So therefore, this name that we come up with, this framework, ethos, which means effective theory of structure formation, but the word effective, I know, that has a different meaning in high energy physics, so I don't want you to get confused by that. It's just a name, and it will become more and more clear what I mean by this effective. So let me start by saying a little bit more about what the theory of structure formation is in the perspective that I will present. And as I was saying earlier, it aims at understanding how the universe came to be from its original state at the time of the CMB, fairly homogeneous, how the density perturbation grew from this state, the large-scale structure of the universe that we observe today, and ultimately how galaxies such as Andromeda here form. So this complete picture of how a galaxy as Andromeda can exist with its dynamical properties is really the whole goal of structure formation. So it's a very ambitious goal. And in this process, or the current theory, it seems that dark matter is very essential for this process to happen. So to explain the kind of density perturbations, no longer perturbations, but very large contrasts that we observe in galaxies, we need dark matter. So the hypothesis is that there is a new particle that exists, that is dark, and there is a set of astronomical observations that give support to this idea from the CMB to the properties of galaxies all across time. Now we know, or we think, we're pretty sure that observations point to the existence of this new form of matter. So this is the essential or key ingredient in the current theory of structure formation. And of course, because of this, there is a lot of effort in trying to detect dark matter as a particle. And usually what is done is to split the dark matter problem into two. So the particle physics and the astrophysics is usually separated. So the particle physics model gives predictions for instance, what kind of production of dark matter you will have, and go to particle colliders and try to search for these kind of interactions, or you might have the possibility that dark matter scatters with nuclei, and then you go ahead and have an experiment here on Earth looking for this possibility of a scattering rate, these direct detection experiments. There is also the possibility that dark matter might self-annihilate, so being its own antiparticle. Then there are also other type of experiments that are looking for these signals, so it self-annihilates and produce standard model particles. So all of these processes in general are done without talking about a connection with dark matter astrophysics. And by that I mean that all of these mechanisms are essentially serve as a way to set the rules from the particle physics of what kind of signals you should expect. And then you take the phase space structure from dark matter, from the predictions of a model that assumes that no other interactions are relevant. So essentially all of this doesn't enter into your predictions for what is the phase space distribution. And the important thing, I think, to keep in mind is that there is yet another possibility, which is that dark matter has hidden interactions, and by that I mean that it can, for example, interact with itself or interact with other new dark particles with essentially no connection with the standard model or with a connection that is weak. But these hidden interactions can impact the phase space distribution of dark matter. And this is really the purpose of this talk, to study or to summarize what is the status of these hidden interactions to have a role for structure formation. And as I said, right now, the structure formation theory, I think I would like to summarize it with this plot, with this slide. Essentially shows what I would think is the state of the art of the structure formation theory. So we have a way of connecting the power spectrum of density fluctuations that we see in the CMB. Then we have cosmological simulations that can follow the nonlinear growth of structure formation, assuming that the only interaction that matters is gravity for dark matter, I mean. This is really another way of seeing what cold dark matter means for structure formation. It means that the only interaction that dark matter can have is gravitational, or the only one that matters really is gravity. Once you have this hypothesis, which is the CDM hypothesis, then you have this what is known as baryonic physics in the field, which is essentially all these complex physical phenomena that we know takes place to really create the stars that we see in the galaxy. So this includes radiative cooling, gas hydrodynamics, star formation, supernovae, and so on and so on. So all of that complex phenomena can now be coupled to this structure formation scenario, and we can create virtual universes in the computer that include all these processes and study really the galactic population in a cosmological framework. This, for example, is the Lustris project. On the left, you see the dark matter density. On the right is the gas density. So all of this is in the computer. And one of the galaxies that appear there has this image that has been mock observed. So this is an actual mock observation from a virtual galaxy. And as you see, well, it looks pretty real. These, of course, are very costly simulations. This one costed nearly 2,000 GPU years. So this is the current status. And I think the thing that I would like to argue is that despite this impressive progress on the CDM model, which has the advantage from the structure formation point of view that it doesn't really have any free parameters, in the sense that once you set your cosmology, then that's it. The rest is just gravity. And from the point of view of dark matter, there is nothing else to do. But of course, we don't know what dark matter is. And more importantly, I think, well, connected to this point is that all of these models that have these names, umbrella terms, right, like cold dark matter, warm dark matter, self-interacting dark matter that I will be talking about, they are really incomplete theories because they don't have a direct connection with a particle physics model. You need to connect them at some point. And in a sense, they are all exotic, as we know, the particle physics models. I mean. So the question that, to me, is more relevant as an astrophysicist is really this one. Of course, we don't know what dark matter is, but more importantly, we don't know yet the answer to this question. So in the physics of galaxies, is gravity really the only dark matter interaction that matters? That's the question that I'm mostly interested about these days. So as I mentioned earlier, you could possibly have these interactions. So once you start looking at what kind of interactions dark matter could have, you could have a scattering with nuclei, or you can have this self-annihilation. So regardless of the theory, these are just cartoons. I'm not going to introduce specific theories. But they just give you an idea, regardless of what happens here, if there is a scattering with nuclei, then we should probably observe something in a detector on Earth, such as LOX. If there is self-annihilation, then maybe the Fermi telescope, which is looking at gamma rays, might detect that signal as well. But these two types of possibilities are very much constrained. So they are really constrained roughly by the weak scale of interaction. So we know that they cannot be much stronger than that, at least in a very wide mass range. So in this table, for example, I put that number. So these are constraints on the cross section for these two processes for scattering. This is for self-annihilation, given by these two experiments, Lox and Fermi. This is roughly 2015, 2016. They might have changed a little bit. But the numbers are very, very small. Again, this weak scale interaction order. And with those kind of interactions, you don't expect to have any effect in structure formation. And the reason is simple. The mean free path is usually, in structures in the universe, is usually even larger than the visible universe. So you are not going to affect the evolution of the structures in this way. So dark is indeed quite dark. So what are the interactions that are relevant for structure formation? So one of them is this.
So I have a question. So there are these things about dark stars. I don't know. I think Katie Brazen has been working on. I mean, I guess she claims that they have effects.
Yeah. So that's true. So as far as I know, they could ignite the first generation of stars, right? So the self-annihilation can basically act as the source of pressure for the formation of the stars. But all of this has, I would say, a secondary impact on structure formation. And even annihilation, right? Annihilation erases some of the density.
So you're talking about star formation today, because I mean, the first stars care about it, and those are also structures, right?
Yeah, but what I mean by structure formation mostly is just the dynamics, the global dynamics, right? So even if the first stars are formed in this way, they are not going to affect the global dynamics, right? At least not in an important way.
Why could they have formed back then but not now? Or are they still relevant? Or
dark stars, you mean?
Yeah
I think it's the you can compute the type of I'm not sure, but I think it's probably the balance between the annihilation rate that was higher back then because the density was higher back then, and how massive the stars can actually be. So there could be annihilation in the center of stars, but no longer dominated by that effect, but by nuclear fusion. No longer sustained by that effect, I mean. So this is the kind of interactions that I'm referring to. So again, I'm not talking about a specific theory, but it's simply to have collisions between the dark matter particles themselves. And there you can imagine that the constraints, observational constraints, are much weaker, because in this case, you don't have a direct connection with the standard model. So you don't have visible byproducts that can come up from the collision of the dark matter particles. So how do you actually detect or constrain these kind of interactions? So a possibility is this one, which is very famous. This is the Bollet cluster. It's a cluster of two massive, it's a collision between two massive clusters. So in green, you see the weak lensing reconstruction of the mass in the clusters. So here is one, here is another one. And these clusters have passed, have collided, as you can see from the gas. So in colors, blue, yellow, red, and white, you see the gas, the hot gas in these clusters emitting X-rays. Most of the ordinary matter is in this hot gas component. So what you see here is essentially the collisional ordinary matter behaving as it should, the gas, right? But the dark matter itself, which dominates the gravity here, passes through each other and essentially behaves as collisionless. It behaves in the similar way as the stars behave. But of course, current observations cannot really constrain this possibility of collisions to a high degree. The current constraint stands of, for the cross-section, stands of the order of 2 cm² per gram. So this is many, many orders of magnitude higher than the other type of constraints. And it acquires really the amplitude of strong interactions. So the fact that dark matter could perhaps be interacting at this order is pretty much open at this moment. And right now there are a set of constraints, so there are difficulties in setting these constraints. There are different astronomical objects that put these constraints and uncertainties, etc., etc. So I think, at least at the moment, there is little point to be as very precise. So instead, I just choose to give, I think, a cartoon is still enough. So if I put the constraints in this plane of the cross-section per unit mass as function of scale, so velocity dispersion in this case for the systems, from small galaxies, dwarf galaxies, Milky Way galaxies, and clusters of galaxies, the constraints are roughly at this level here. So this 1 or 2 centimeters squared per gram. And there is really not much constraints below the Milky Way scale. So below this scale, at the scale of dwarf galaxies, there is essentially no constraints. So you can have very high cross sections in that case. It is possible, actually, that you have a cross section, so a new type of interaction between the dark matter particles that is very significant at the scale of galaxies, and even at the scale of clusters is still relevant, and essentially escapes all observational constraints now, currently that we have. But still, when I'm talking about collisional dark matter or self-interacting dark matter, one has to keep in mind that this is not really the collisional gas that is, for example, in this room. This is a very rarefied gas. So with 1 cm² per gram, roughly, the average scattering rate per particle that you expect is around 1 in a Hubble time. So they collide, but they collide rarely. And this also makes them interesting because it's hard to model them. At least you cannot model them as a fluid because they are not in the fluid regime. And of course, you cannot model them as is currently or done in a standard way in n-body simulations because they are not collisionless. So they are in this intermediate regime. The other possibility is that it comes in many of these models where you have this possibility of, say, dark matter colliding with themselves. So this could be analogous to, say, the Coulomb interaction, right, between electrons. And you could also have the mediators of those interactions playing a role. So the photons, the equivalent of the photons, could be these dark photons, so these hidden interactions in a dark sector. So analogous to Compton scattering, you will have a scattering between these dark photons and dark matter. And this scattering has important implications for specifically for the early universe, because then you have a form of radiation pressure that comes from these dark photons. So instead of the normal scenario where dark matter essentially, in the early universe, the density perturbations start growing, and in the standard scenario, there is no source of radiation pressure. But if you have radiation pressure, then there is something that is going to balance gravity from collapsing, which is the radiation pressure. It's very much similar to what happens between photons and electrons and protons in the early universe. So this creates dark acoustic oscillations analogous to the baryonic acoustic oscillations. So you have a phenomenon that can essentially counteract gravity, as I said. And once the photons, the dark photons, and the dark matter decouple, then you create a scale, a characteristic cutoff scale, that is connecting to the sound horizon scale, in this case, between the dark radiation and dark matter. And again, this is a possibility that is allowed by observations because the clustering, really, of matter hasn't been constrained all the way down to the scales that matter for structure formation. So once again, I keep on emphasizing this word because this is what I think is relevant for structure formation. And I will be more clear about that, but what you're seeing here is the power spectrum, so essentially the amplitude of fluctuations, the degree of clustering as a function of scale, in K, here in mass. And of course, we know that CDM works very well. Here are, by the way, the baryonic acoustic oscillations. CDM works very well, and basically there is a constraint on this power spectrum roughly at this scale. 10 to the 10 at scale of dwarf galaxies. But below, there's really no constraints or no firm constraints. And this scale is important because this is precisely the scale that sets the minimum size that galaxies can have, which is these dwarf galaxies. So if we push this constraint a couple of orders of magnitude, maybe just one order of magnitude to the right in mass, then whatever happens below the scale, below this, that scale, it would be irrelevant for galaxy formation. But right now, the possibility is open that there is a cutoff in this power spectrum, so that there is a scale introduced by dark matter physics that is relevant for setting the scale for galaxy formation.
So and energy is 10 keV, right?
For warm dark matter in this example, yeah, this is just an example with 8 kilo electron volts.
Okay, 8
keV, yes. And this is your, I put it here, well, it comes from really from this paper from 2012. But this is the standard, very well known warm dark matter case, right? Where there the cutoff is set by the free streaming of particles. So basically, by the time the particles stop being relativistic. Here I'm talking about a new cutoff, which has these dark acoustic oscillations that you see there. And there the cutoff or the scale is introduced by this sound horizon scale and by this collisional damping. So this is similar to silk damping, damping, but in the dark sector.
So collisional damping from the self-interaction of dark matter.
No, it's not from the self-interaction. It's from the interaction between dark radiation and dark matter.
Dark radiation, okay.
Yeah. So this possibility is there. So I think this offers an opportunity, and this is where this ETOS framework that I will describe in a moment comes about. So first, I think whether we like it or not, galaxies are really the only dark matter detectors we have, in the sense of all these experiments that are ongoing trying to detect dark matter, there's no clear positive signal. So they really, galaxies remain, in a way, the best dark matter detectors. There are others, say, for example, you could argue the CMB. And I think there is an opportunity to look at the detail of how the properties of these galaxies are in reality to have a hint on the nature of dark matter. And this makes it, I think this is very timely to do this because there's really a very narrow window, a relatively narrow window, for this to be relevant. There are these two scenarios that I discuss. One is connected with the cutoff in the power spectrum. And I think there is roughly an order of magnitude in mass where this could be relevant. So if you go above this value, then we know that things should be a CDM. If you go below this value, all of these are, of course, rough values. This is the halo mass at redshift zero. If you go below this value, then you start getting into the regime where we know that ordinary matter is very, very relevant. And this has to do with the heating caused by the first generation of stars in the universe during the epoch of reionization. For the cross-section, right, this other possibility of self-collision between the dark matter, then you also have roughly this window. If you go much higher, then you have problems with observational constraints. If you go much lower, then it's relevant. It doesn't really matter. It's not going to make a huge difference. So I think this is why it's very important to try to close these windows or explore them to see if there is a signature of new dark matter physics there.
Sorry, I missed the. Can you explain again the
M-cut
physics?
Yeah, the M-cut is just a. It's the halo mass. It's the mass that a halo, a dark matter halo, should have at redshift zero in isolation. Yeah. So you can connect the cutoff in the power spectrum roughly to this scale. This is just to give a sense of the scale. And this opportunity is what really inspired this idea of trying to generalize the theory of structure formation. So as I said, the name comes from this effective word that we said there, but I will describe in a second what I mean by effective. And the idea is to connect, to generalize this theory of structure formation to allow for essentially all possibilities here for the dark matter physics that you could have, and connect that self-consistently with a theory that includes the connection with the ordinary matter and uniform galaxies in a more broader sense that includes these possibilities of new dark matter interactions. And of course, I should mention that this is a project in collaboration with a number of people. Now the number has grown a little bit more, but these are, in a way, the core members of this effort. So the ingredients of this framework consists of looking at the linear regime of structure formation and the impact of these dark matter and dark radiation interactions. And then the nonlinear regime, you have the dark matter self-collisions. And perhaps more importantly is to look for these effective parameters for structure formation and the connection that these parameters have with particle physics model. And I think there is where this framework becomes more appealing. So the idea is to start with a classification of particle physics models, not according to the particle physics parameters, so the mass of dark matter particles, the couplings, for example, the mass of the mediators, et cetera, et cetera. So all of those particle physics parameters that you pick from a given model, say this one here, you take them and then you you take them and try to map them into effective parameters that describe structure formation. And you do that in two steps, or we did that in two steps. So first is the linear regime where you can actually use perturbation theory to solve the equations for the growth of structures. So in the linear regime, as I said, you mostly care about the interactions between dark matter and dark radiation. So your starting point is the collisional Boltzmann equation. So the F is the phase space distribution, and then you have a set of coupled Boltzmann equations that have the evolution of this distribution function for the dark matter and dark radiation, and the coupling here comes from the collisional term between dark matter and dark radiation in the Boltzmann equation. On the linear regime, the density perturbations are very small, so you can use perturbation theory, the standard perturbation theory, and then you end up, of course, with very similar equations, but with an important difference. So I'm not going to describe the whole equations. Essentially, this is the continuity equation, and this would be equivalent to the Euler equation if this was a zero here, or the standard, say, equation for dark matter. So in the case of collisional CDM, this would be zero. But once you have these interactions, you introduce a new term, which is connected to the opacity of the dark radiation to dark matter. So essentially, this opacity term contains all the information that you have between because of this collisional term that is here. So this opacity creates, as I explained earlier, a very different evolution for the density perturbation. So instead of the standard scenario where the CDM perturbation starts growing, then there is the entering horizon, then you have this Mesaros effect, and then it continues growing. That's the standard, very well-known scenario. In the case of this dark radiation possibility, then you have the oscillations, right? Because you have a balance between gravity and the pressure, the radiation pressure. So you have the fluctuation really doesn't grow. After a while, actually, the dark photons can diffuse the dark matter perturbations, so they suppress the world, the growth. So this is this silk damping. And then you have, once the universe cools down enough, then you have a decouple between the dark photons and the dark matter. And then dark matter can grow again. So this is very, very similar to how baryons, baryonic perturbations would grow in the early universe. So it's entirely analogous, just different scales. So at the end, we have all this cosmological perturbation theory developed with these new possibilities. And the function that matters is this opacity that I mentioned earlier.
You have only one parameter, not just the opacity.
It's really the opacity, but the opacity depends on the characteristics of the cross sections that you have. So, for example, what kind of angular dependence it has, what kind of momentum dependence it has. So that creates some differences in the final, say, power spectrum that you have. But yeah, the key is that that opacity can be expanded in a series of coefficients with a certain redshift dependence. So these coefficients, An, are connected to the matrix element, so essentially how the amplitude of the cross-section scales with the momentum transfer during this dark radiation, dark matter interactions. So your particle physics parameters are really mapped at the end into a set of parameters, one of them, or you know, is really a series, depending on your particle physics models, one connected to this momentum dependence, and the other one that I don't describe in detail, this alpha here, that depends on this angular dependence. So the whole idea is to, instead of talk about these parameters, let's talk about these ones, because these control how the power spectrum looks like. And that's what matters for structure formation. There is also the other thing that matters, which is the transfer cross-section. So this is the cross-section for self-interactions. And that we can also compute self-consistently from the theory. So at the end, we have these effective parameters, and there is where really that's the whole point of the word. There is nothing more to it. But to say that you have these ethos parameters that control how this power spectrum is going to look like. So the scale where this turns off and the amplitude actually of the first acoustic oscillation is all that matters for structure formation. You might have all these secondary details, but because here the power is much smaller than the CDM baseline, they are going to be essentially irrelevant for structure formation. What matters really is how quick the cutoff happens. And this we have learned with experiments using simulations. For each of these models, so these are just benchmark models, we have also a way to compute the cross-section as a function of velocity. So this would be the equivalent of, say, your router for scattering cross-section. So we have this set of possibilities, and
can you go? So I'm trying to say, so these are independent parameters. The cross section is one thing, and then the alphas and a's are another thing.
Yes.
And is you're saying that the oscillations don't matter, or do they?
Yes. So when you see this plot here, from the experience that we have from the n-body simulations, and this is something that we are planning on doing, is this is really half the work. So now we have this way of connecting these two, and we can produce this input power spectrum from our simulations, which I will describe in a second, and this transfer cross-section. When I put this into the computer, all of these things here don't matter, and this is essentially because the nonlinear evolution tends to erase the memory of all this. But the first cutoff is very, very relevant because it sets the scale. And the second, it turns out to be relevant as well, because there is extra power at smaller scales that, for example, you would expect in warm dark matter. So this is what I mean by all these oscillations not mattering for structure formation. And the same can be said about the transfer cross-section. Once you go to very large velocities, all of these, the amplitude here is irrelevant because it's too small. It's just really the baselines that you, order of magnitude that you have here that is important. So as a kind of a side note that some of you might be wondering, and I think it was related to your question earlier, if you have self interactions between the dark matter particles themselves, can they introduce a cutoff in the power spectrum? After all, there should be a cutoff because of that. But the thing is that that cutoff, because you have roughly this degree of possibility for the scattering, then that cutoff is very, very small. So you can compute the Yin's mass associated to this. And for self-interacting dark matter only without other interactions, the power spectrum would be exactly the same. So you do need this dark radiation or extra interactions to have an impact on the power spectrum.
And this, no matter how strong it is?
If you go very, very strong, then you violate all kinds of constraints.
Yeah, but I get that. But there are scenarios that you can have this stronger in the past, but then because there's temperature dependence, for example.
Yeah, if you have something like that, I don't remember the scaling right now, but this is for 0.1. So you have to go, I think the scaling is, I don't remember the power law with sigma, but you have to increase it quite a bit to go from 10 to the minus 11 to 10 to the 10. I mean, it's 20 orders of magnitude in mass. So let me describe the second part of the ingredients, which is the nonlinear regime. So in that case, you can no longer do perturbation theory, it breaks down. There, the dark matter dark radiation interactions are no longer relevant because you have essentially kinetic decoupling between dark radiation and dark matter. But these two, which were irrelevant in the early universe, now start becoming more and more relevant because the densities in the center of halos start growing and growing. So the mean free path becomes comparable to the size of the galaxy. So in this case, you have to use, you cannot use perturbation theory. And in a way, you would have to solve the full collisional Boltzmann equation, which is this one here, for the possibility of these dark matter collisions. And the way we do it is to discretize this phase space distribution using n-body simulations, but with the addition of collisions. So how do we actually do that? We do it in the way it's done in a standard way, which is just discretize distribution function. I will not go into too much details also because I'm 40 minutes already on time. But at the end, essentially what we do is to have gravity. So this is purely Newtonian gravity. And then we have a probabilistic method for elastic scattering. The n-body simulation consists in you take your result from your linear theory, so you take your input power spectrum, and then you map that into a particle realization. So this is how you do this discretization. You have a box in the computer which gives you the maximum size, so the maximum mode in K that you can have for the representation of the power spectrum. And then you are also going to have a resolution because, of course, in the computer, you are going to be limited. You cannot have infinite resolution. And that's going to set the minimum scale or the maximum K that you can resolve. So this is done in the standard way. I'm going to skip this one that describes this probabilistic method. And I'm just going to talk about the consequences of this in the last maybe 10 minutes or so. And I will describe essentially what are the main differences between this more generalized theory of structure formation and CDM. So you have probably seen this kind of pictures before. So this is map density of the distribution of dark matter, so surface density essentially, in CDM. So this is the cosmic web structure at large scales. I think this is 50 megaparsecs roughly. And when you zoom into one of these objects, you get something like a Milky Way halo. Now, it's well known that in CDM, what you have is a situation where halos are predicted to be filled with these smaller structures, substructure. There is a lot of research done into the properties of such structures and how to actually identify them. Because these substructures, maybe the most massive ones, contain galaxies, satellite galaxies around our Milky Way. But the least massive ones essentially don't have the potential, the gravitational potential to ignite star formation. So they are in a way dark. There is a lot of research, as I said, to try to identify them, because that would verify, in a way, the CDM model. But the important thing, at least for the purpose of what I have to say, is that in CDM, there is no scale for galaxy formation, because the free streaming for CDM particles is extremely small. So it doesn't matter. It's not going to impact the minimum galactic scale. And the second point is that the phase is space density, so the maximum density that can exist, say, at the center of these halos, is set just by the primordial thermal motion of the dark matter particles. And again, that's very, very high. So the prediction for CDM is to have many of these structures and also very high densities in the center. That's well known. In the case where you introduce dark matter dark radiation, then you have a galactic scale set by this physics, and the phase space density is, in this case, set by the thermalization of the inner halos. So in a way, there is a lot of information in this plot, but at the end, essentially, what I'm trying to say here is what is here in red. You can read it yourself, but it's what I mentioned a little bit earlier, that you have this extreme abundance of vast abundance of dark matter structures that should be there in the universe. And in the case, once you introduce a cutoff scale, well, you suppress that abundance. So you have a suppression, this is the halo mass function, so you have a suppression on the abundance of halos. And this is as a consequence of dark matter-dark radiation interactions. Now, as a consequence of self-interacting dark matter, then the structure of halos changes significantly. You can see it here at a glance, kind of a little bit in more detail, CDM versus self-interacting dark matter for a Milky Way size halo. In the case of CDM, as I said, the halo, well, this I didn't mention, but the halos are triaxial. So this is because there is not perfect spherical symmetry in the way that gravity acts. So some of the directions are more elongated than others. You have lots of structures and very dense centers. In the case of self-interactions, you have lower densities, you have spherical halos, and in principle, less abundance of halos as well. And how much time I have? Maybe 5 minutes?
You have 15 minutes.
Okay, then I can maybe explain this a little bit in detail, a little bit more, a bit more time. So I wanted to just stop and give you an idea of why you expect this lower density of halos in the center because of self-interactions. And the way I like to describe this is in the following. So in CDM, we know here on the left you have the spherical average density as a function of scale. So you take one of these halos, you put the center, the position from the center, you measure the spherical average density in shells, and then you would get something like this. If you do the same, but instead with the density, you talk about the velocity dispersion, which is a measure, say, of the temperature of the system. If you interpret the velocity dispersion, so the random motions, as a measure of temperature, of course, we have to be careful with temperature here, because these are collisionless system, so I'm talking about CDM. Then you get this bell shape here. And this is just the solution that you get from the equilibrium or genes configuration from this density distribution here. Now imagine that you switch on collisions. So what happens is that the mean free path is the smallest here, so the probability of scattering is largest where the density is largest. But also the kinetic energy available for the particles here in the center is also the smallest. So whenever there is a collision, there is an energy exchange from the surrounding particles to the inside. So in a way, there is a flux of heat from the outside to the inside, just because this part has higher kinetic energy than this one. And that means that the orbits of the particles in the inside are going to expand and create this isothermal core. Why creates an isothermal core? As I said, it's because of these heat flux, and it keeps on going, this process, until you reach the maximum possible temperature that you can have, which is set by the maximum velocity dispersion that you had here. So after many dynamical times, this is the quasi-equilibrium configuration that you get. But that's not the whole story. What happens after this stage is that you no longer have particles with higher kinetic energy here. Instead, you are surrounded by colder particles around. So in that sense, if collisions continue to happen between this particle and here the boundary particles, then this is reversed. The heat flow flux happens in the other direction, like this. And this is something that is sometimes not very well known about self-interacting dark matter. But if you let time go on, then actually the center of the self-interacting dark matter halos are going to collapse. So this is just a transitory stage. This is better understood with this model that was developed originally by Lindenbell and others. I'm not going to go into detail, but you can understand this process of the formation of the core and then its subsequent collapse by just looking at these sets of equations. So this is the Jeans equation, the Fourier law for thermal conduction, and then something analogous to the first law. And the important thing here is that the conductivity, so the thermal conduction, is set by the scales of the problem, which is the relaxation time at a characteristic scale, which would depend in which kind of regime you are. So originally, Lindenbell did this for collisionless systems, actually, for stars in globular clusters. Because what I described earlier can actually happen for collisional systems for stars if you have two-body relaxation. So you have two regimes. If you are in the fluid regime, then the scale that matters is the mean free path, and it's controlled just by the scale of interaction of your cross-section. If you are in the collision regime, then it's the Jeans mass that controls the scale. So both in globular clusters and in self-interacting dark matter halos, you have this formation of an isothermal core, and then the subsequent collapse, which is called the gravothermal collapse, which is summarized in this image here, which shows the radius, the density, and time. So you start with something, as I said, as in CDM, that grows towards the center. Then you form the core because of self-interactions. But eventually, if you wait long enough, then your system collapses. So the fate of all self-interacting dark matter halos is at the end actually to be even denser than CDM.
So for realistic cross-sections, does this happen for any halo?
So for between 1 and 10 centimeters squared per gram, that's larger than the Hubble time. So you really don't care. But once you go above 10, it's actually it's not too far. So if you have models where at the scale of dwarf galaxies, you have much more than 10, then this is going to happen.
So do you know what happens after the collapse?
A black hole.
Does it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, this paper explores that possibility in the early universe. And so the idea of the gravothermal collapse has been known for some time, but they really put it forward as a possibility to explain supermassive black holes in the early universe. But I have to say that the formation of black holes here, so this, they basically just said, well, you know, once these equations break down, which of course they will, then they just use a Bondi accretion type of criteria to say that you are going to have a black hole. But black hole formation hasn't been studied in detail really properly in these scenarios.
The halo itself doesn't form the black hole.
Sorry?
The halo itself doesn't form a black hole.
There are still black holes, and then these are feeding.
It could help it grow.
Yes, I should have said that. You're right, yes. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I think I probably should skip this. Well, this is just to say that the scale, so the size of the core, so the scale depends on the amplitude of the cross-section, as I mentioned earlier, and also on the size of the system. So again, just always kind of talking about the typical scales that you would expect from relevant self-interactions. These are roughly kiloparsec scale for dwarf galaxies here. And you know, maybe even much larger, say 100 even kiloparsec scale at the scale of clusters. Of course, modulated with your cross-section. Let me just say a last few words about what else happens with the structure of self-interacting dark matter halos is the ellipticity. So I mentioned, this is just to say it in a little bit more detail. So the halo evolves from something that is essentially triaxial. So these are the major axes of the inertia tensor. So in CDM, you expect something that is roughly triaxial. And once you include interactions, then that evolves towards something more spherical. So this is why this grows closer to one. Also, the anisotropy, so the velocity anisotropy, you also tend to isotropize the orbits because of the collisions. So the velocity anisotropy becomes closer to zero, at least where interactions are more relevant. And then, of course, the velocity distribution evolves towards a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. We know that the final solution of a system that is collisional for the distribution function should be the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So in self-interaction, in SIDM, you evolve towards that solution. And you erase the memory of the assembly of the dark matter halos. So that's a very important property of CDM halos, which is that there is an imprint on how the halo was assembled into the velocity distribution because particles are collisionless. And you actually measure the velocity distribution function average at the scale that you can in the simulations. Then you have these features here, these bumps, that are connected with the assembly history of the halo. And that assembly is, of course, erased by collisions, as you can imagine, because of the thermalization or the isotropization of the orbits. So let me conclude by that and just try to make a summary of what I said. And the most important thing that I would like you to take home is that this window is essentially relatively narrow, and it allows to explore if there are signatures of new dark matter physics in the properties of galaxies. And I think to explore this possibility, you need to go and actually do the full more general theory of structure formation that includes these possibilities. And I think this is, in a way, unavoidable at this moment, because you cannot just take CDM as a prior and develop your galaxy formation theory with that prior, because it will always be affected by that choice. And I think by now, the simulations are cheap enough, in a way, that you can introduce this new interaction without, you know, too much overhead. So I think it's very important to do it, and this is why we are doing it. And I talk about these two main possibilities that are connected to these windows. One is the dark matter radiation scale of this damping, and the other one is self-interacting dark matter. And what I said that in general, for self-interacting dark matter, so here you introduce this minimum scale for galaxy formation, and in this case, the prediction is that the structure, the inner structure of halo should be very different. So more spherical, lower densities, the memory of assembly is erased. And the second part, which is important to keep in mind, is this runaway collapse that happens if the cross-section crosses a certain threshold. Or of course, if in the future, this should be the prediction for these kind of models. And finally, just to end, I would like to say that there is much more I would like to say about this framework, especially once you couple it to the physics of the ordinary matter, and that's what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. So before the questions, so I guess we're going to have lunch with Jesus afterwards, and there will be a speaker dinner at 6 in the bistro. So everybody's welcome to join. It's funded by the Cosmology Group. So, and if you want to learn more about the astrophysical aspects of what Jesus is doing, come to his talk tomorrow, just across the park at UW. And Jesus is here today and tomorrow, and I guess, his office is at but tomorrow at the university, today here, 3:34.
3:34,
yes. I can tell you later. So, questions for Jesus?
I was wondering, can you state your window in terms of dimensionless coupling constants if you were making a model, a field theory model?
I for sure I cannot do it at the moment. I'm not sure how to. I suppose a way is to go to this. This is the other direction. A way would be to go to this mapping that we have established. So you will have to essentially connect this A. So how, depending on your interaction, for example, I think for this particular model, the only n that is relevant is 4. So depending on the model, you are going to have one of these coefficients, right? And that's going to give you the connection between these and these coefficients, and that would give you at least the connection with the power spectrum and this cutoff mass that I described. In regards to the cross section,
You have diet. Do you have an order of magnitude?
No.
But it's not dimensionless because it depends on the mass of the particle. If the particles are more massive, then it's a smaller cross section. And then because there's a scale there, which is the density of dark matter. So it would be a combination of the mass and the.
So there would be some region of mass and coupling constant.
That's right. I bet that's the quantity. So I can ask one question, if I may. So one thing that's become hot recently is this fuzzy dark matter. So I guess, does that fit into ETHOS or not? I have you thought about that?
I think it would fit in the sense of, so to me, really the classification that matters is as long as you can provide these two as an input. So in the case of fuzzy dark matter, you are going to have also a cutoff in the power spectrum.
Right, but the cutoff is not in the initial conditions. It's something that, there would be any cutoff initial condition, maybe, but
yes,
it's too light.
So it's very light, right? So you would have this effective quantum pressure that I guess, at late.
So you also create cores, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to put it into this framework now. But the idea is always, or the idea we have is generic in the sense of, can you map whatever it is your particle physics model is into these two conditions, right? Something that generates cores, so the size of the scale that you affect for the dynamics of the galaxy, right, has to be roughly 1 kiloparsec or so. So if you can map the particle physics models into 1 kiloparsec size cores or impact on the dark matter density, then you don't need to run a numerical simulation for each of these models, right? As long as you know what kind of size you expect for the cores.
I guess this seems that there might be a new dimension that you haven't explored in this fuzzy dark matter, because it's not the collisional effect, but it's this quantum effect for very low mass particles.
But at the end, you have also a core that has very similar properties.
But it doesn't collapse, for example.
It doesn't collapse.
I don't think it has a collapse because it's such like a soliton of some sort. I don't think there is a gravitational catastrophe.
It's a type of collapse on the glide scale. There's a quantum pressure, but there's also another pressure that corresponds to the
the self-interactions. Mm-hmm. And if that term is dominant, it would look very much like this picture, I think.
Yeah.
It depends on the relative size of those two.
The self-interaction of the axioms, you mean? Okay, so but we think there is the core collapse that happens? Because, I mean, one thing is...
It's all totally unstable.
The solvent is unstable, so what happens to the solvent?
It could collapse to a black hole.
It could collapse to a black hole. Okay, that would be interesting. Okay. Okay, that's interesting. Other questions? I guess I have, maybe if there is no one, I've asked my last question, which is, so you're thinking about halos in isolation, but I mean, of course, these dwarf galaxies are in bigger halos that have higher velocity dispersions. So if you do have these self-interactions, wouldn't they evaporate?
Yes, but you need very high, so you need at least, well, not so high. To start being relevant, you need 10 centimeters squared per gram. Then you start reducing and having evaporation, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, that's a possibility. But then even with 10 centimeters squared per gram, you don't really reduce. You start reducing the number density, the abundance of subhalos, but not to the point where it becomes, say, very relevant.
Okay.
In relation to the missing satellite problem,
for
example. It's not a big effect. It needs to be higher than that.
Okay. Okay, well, let's thank Jesus again.
Thank you.